Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello there. This is John Doe. Please tune in to Pamela DeBar's Pajama Party. It's so many peas, you'll pee your pants.
Welcome to Pamela DeBar's Pajama Party, a Pantheon podcast. Music, culture, conversation, and good old-fashioned rock and roll. So now, I give you Miss Pamela and her pajama party.
Hello, dolls, and welcome to Pamela DeBar's pajama party. And boy, do I have a party for you today. I got to chat for an hour, which I've done many times, with one of my best friends, Cassandra Peterson, who plays Elvira, as I'm sure you all know. And she has a new book out, which is really a fabulously written tell-all. And I got to help her with it, which made me very happy. I helped her edit. I assisted her quite a bit, and I'm overjoyed by how it came out. And, you know, I am so thrilled that she's here today. I just want to say another little couple things about me. You can find out everything I'm doing on my website, PamelaDeBarOfficial.com. I have so much stuff going on, brand new t-shirts and masks, believe it or not. I'm with the band, just tons of stuff. But right now I am going to introduce you to my darling doll, Cassandra Peterson.
Elvira. Elvira.
Cassandra, I'm so thrilled to see you, darling. Oh my God, you moved away. Oh, I'm so devastated you moved away.
No, I miss you and all my friends. That's the only hard part about leaving LA. That part really sucks, I'm telling you.
Yes, Cassandra moved to Oregon, which I was just devastated about. But, you know, I understand, you know, you've been in Hollywood most of your life.
48 years.
48 years in Hollywood. And I mean, what made you say, okay, I'm out of here?
Well, I don't know. You know, I don't know. It's getting hotter down there. It's getting drier.
Yes.
My neighborhood, I mean, I live in the middle of Hollywood. And
yes.
And man, it was just getting like almost unsafe to just walk down to the store and stuff. I mean, I got accosted by some crazy nut. Who chased me, and I had to jump in a car, like a stranger's car, and get away. Just stuff like that. And, you know, it's just like kind of, I don't know. The 70s Hollywood was really, really bad. The beginning of the 70s, how it got really dirty and bad and cruddy. But I think it's worse now. I mean, have you
really
driven Sunset Boulevard? It's getting scary down there.
Well, it's scary in the valley.
Yeah, yeah, and everywhere.
It is. It really is. But you feel better. I mean, do you feel good where you moved to? I mean, I can't wait to see it. I am going to come visit.
Well, it snowed today. Woke up to the entire ground, everything covered in snow. I'm not like ready for that, really.
Yeah. Well, you know, Mother Nature is pissed off as we all know, and she's going to do it. She's going to do wherever she wants to do it.
That's true. And there's no running, no hiding, you know,
no.
you're Elon Musk and you can launch yourself into space. But
yes.
Who the hell wants to live in some kind of a bunker on Mars? You know,
I mean, not me.
Really?
I'm going to stick it out here with my sweet Mother Earth.
Me
for the rest
too,
of my life.
Last. God. But anyway, you know, I think the main problem is that LA is a city of almost 8 million people.
Yeah.
8 million. And I think it's become kind of ungovernable.
Ungovernable?
Yeah.
Huh.
You know, I mean, because it's like a country.
Yes. Oh, it should be a country.
Yeah.
I've always thought it should at least be separate from the rest of the freaking country.
Yeah. You know, I worked on campaigns for years and years. I did it so many times. I became a delegate for Jerry Brown. I went to Washington. I did everything.
I know you're very committed to good vibes. I know that.
Thank you. And I was working on getting Hollywood to be its own city.
Yeah.
You know, West Hollywood. And because as soon as West Hollywood got its own city, it became so much nicer. You know, it got some of the government's money to fix things up. But anyway, that never panned out. So finally, I'm like, I can't keep working on this thing that's never going to happen. So I split to a city that's less than 800,000.
Wow.
So much easier to get around in. And oh, and the traffic in LA. I mean,
I know. You have to add an hour coming and going. And if you're going to Disneyland, like I like to do, forget it. Takes forever to get
the whole day. The whole day. I mean, just going to the airport, which I was doing all the time before. Every week. It was like from my house, like an hour, you know, hour and a half, depending on the time.
Oh, yeah.
Here, from my house, it's 20 minutes at the highest traffic time. So it's like, oh, what a relief.
I know there are some bonuses. I really love Portland. You know, I used to, before the pandemic, I would come twice a year and teach my writing workshops. So as soon as this clears up a little, which seems maybe it is, I will be there again a lot because I do love Portland. One of my oldest friends lives there and I've got other good friends. So,
yeah, well, stay with us. You can stay here.
Okay. That'll be awesome.
Can't wait to see you.
Let's get into, you know, this is a music podcast. You know, my Pantheon is a music podcast place.
Yeah.
So you wrote a fabulous book, which I was honored to help you with. To some degree, and it was just so well done. You know, people don't, you know, they, so many people say, oh, I'm gonna write a book, and they say it maybe in their last breath on earth.
I said it for approximately 15 years. I got so bored of hearing me say that. It was like, don't even tell me about it. But I mean, with your encouragement, Pamela, I've said in many interviews,
thank you.
I didn't write this book until Pamela Daybar told me kind of how to do it, helped me get an agent, your agent.
He's a good guy.
Helped me write the outline and everything so that I could sell it. Yeah. I mean, if it hadn't been for you, I would have never done this book. So honestly, thank you.
Well, I remember how that came about. We hadn't seen each other in a while and you reached out to me and said, it's been too long, let's have dinner.
Yep.
And you know, that restaurant's over now, and it was such a good restaurant. I forget the name of it, but it was good.
It's gone?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Oh.
Yeah. So anyway, we talked about it that night and I, yes, you know, and you actually did it. Now it's what made you finally say, okay, I'm just going to write this. I'm actually going to do this.
Well, you.
<What's>
Well, just the, I don't know. I have had so many people over my life say, you have got to write a book because you had the weirdest freaking life. You have to write a book. And I just kept saying, I will, don't you worry. Someday I will. But you know, I turned 70 last September and it was like, I'm coming up on my 70th birthday. If I don't write it now, when am I going to write it? When I'm 90, you know, I mean, So I just got the pressure of like, I've got to do it. And really, once you help me get an agent and I got a book deal, then it was like, hey, I'm going to get paid to do it. So
yeah,
I can take time off of my other work that I do every day and I can sit down. I mean, I sat down and worked literally 7 days a week and I enjoyed it a lot. Well, there were days I didn't enjoy it as much. Oh, yeah, there were days you just go, no, I can't do it.
Anything but this.
Yeah. I mean it. And especially when you're writing about things you don't want to write about, like my divorce and like,
difficult things. Sure, you have to, because that inspires people to get through their difficulties.
Yeah.
And what has your feedback been like? Well, okay, first of all, what's the book called for people, you know, who live under a rock and don't know you've written one?
Yeah, it's called Yours Cruelly, Elvira.
Yes.
The feedback has been absolutely phenomenal. I mean, first of all, I got on the New York Times bestseller list for 4 weeks.
Right away.
I never dreamed that would happen. That was like, are you kidding? I didn't.
Really?
I thought it's going to be a minor book, but, you know, hopefully it'll sell a bunch of copies, at least to my fans, you know. But it went so far out of those boundaries.
Yeah.
I'm thrilled to say I'm really glad that it's not just my fans who I love, and I'm thrilled that they love it, but it kind of leaks out into music fans. You know, because I have a lot of rock and roll stuff there, a lot of groupie stuff, as you
know. Of course. And,
it leaks out into the, you know, people who are interested in the whole, you know, women, with the Me Too movement. I mean, it has a lot of other things other than horror. I think a lot of people might think, oh, it's just about horror and Elvira.
Not at all. Yeah.
No. There's, of course, that's included, but it's about my whole life growing up on a farm in Kansas and being from a very poor background and getting to where I am now, which is very comfortable and, you know, and fairly well known. And
yes,
I want that to inspire people. That not just elite people get to be well known, not just people with tons of money put into them, you know, by someone.
But you worked so hard too, and all the work that you've put into your life is all through this book too. But I think a lot of people, if they haven't read this book yet, or Let's Spend the Night Together, my book that you have a chapter in, probably have no idea you were a groupie and don't even mind the word.
No, I don't think they do. There's a lot of things about my life that before Elvira, I think that, but I always say to people, when I became Elvira, that's when my life calmed down and got normal.
Yeah.
Before that, it was pretty crazy.
Yes. And what, I mean, early music that you loved, you know, the same stuff I did. We're in a similar age group.
Very similar.
So we like the same stuff. And you wound up hanging out with some pretty amazing, you know, people that I think people will be surprised about, such as, I mean, let's start pretty early, the Jimmy Page encounter.
Yeah, mine wasn't as fun as yours was, but still pretty exciting.
Well, he was in the Yardbirds at the time.
Yep, which I knew, one of my favorite bands of all time, really.
And still, right? It didn't color your love of the music, the fact that he was a bit of an a-hole.
Oh, hell no. I like him just as much now as I ever did. I mean, he's brilliant. I mean, come on, this guy.
Yes.
You know, look at all the stuff he's done. And you know, I was surprised to learn that he actually is the person who started Led Zeppelin. It really was Jimmy Page.
Oh, I mean, he's
started, you know,
he's very focused Capricorn.
Yeah.
You know what, though? Let's hear a song by the Yardbirds right now.
Great.
Yes, he was quite a special dude.
Still is.
You know, he's become this elder statesman, you know, with gray hair and a ponytail.
Yeah, no, he's very handsome now. I got to say, he aged really well, which a lot of Englishmen don't, you know?
And I'm surprised he did, because he really put himself through the ringer in many, many ways. But he's come out of it. But tell us how you met him.
Yeah, that was so dorky. It was, I think I was 13 or maybe 14, somewhere right around in there. And I heard that the Yardbirds were coming to Colorado Springs, where I lived, and they were going to play at the City Auditorium. And so a girlfriend of mine, Kathy, and I started scoping out the town. We knew they had to be staying somewhere downtown, you know it. So we went to like the fanciest hotel that there was. There was only two hotels, I say in my book. We went from hotel to hotel until we found them. And that was literally it, two hotels. But we walked up and down the every floor. I think it had maybe seven floors, until we came to a door that we could hear somebody inside playing loud rock music, you know.
So smart, so clever for 13.
I was a teenage detective. And we knocked on the door. We were just dying. And there was Keith Relf. He answered the door, and
God,
we tried to talk, almost fainted, and went inside. He was drawing a little picture with some ink pens, and my friend Kathy ended up shampooing Jim McCarty, the drummer's, hair in the sink. I don't know why that happened. Suddenly,
oh boy,
Paige just kind of stalks into the room, grabs me by the hand, takes me out of the room, down to another room, takes me in there, jumps on me. And I mean, I had no experience with guys. I had by then kissed a guy, but that is about it. I was a very late bloomer, even though.
Well, no, late bloomers, you know, 13 and 14 is not late.
Yeah, maybe not. I mean, by today's standards, I guess I was a late bloomer. Then I wasn't.
Yeah.
however, when I was 14, I was already starting to be a go-go dancer in nightclubs. But I had no experience with guys. And then he's jumping on me. And then, ew. I don't know. I don't know if I'm going to get into details. Maybe you have to read the book for that. But I got away from him and ran down the hall. I was half dressed and ran into a whole group of guys waiting for the elevator, businessmen, and ran down the hall, got my friend Kathy, and ran downstairs to my aunt, who was waiting for him. She was the one who dropped us off there, which was, I'm sure she had no idea what was going on. It was just like, oh yes, you want to meet these nice guys in the band? Okay. I don't know what the hell she was thinking.
Well, it was new. The word groupie didn't even exist yet.
Yeah, no, it didn't exist. And I didn't know what to expect. I sort of just went there to see if I could get an autograph, you know?
Yeah.
A lot more than that.
Yeah. And he was quite, shall we say, energetic about trying to, you know, keep you in the room, right?
Oh, yeah. No, he jumped on top of me. The next thing I know, he's pulling out his wang, you know, and I'm like,
oh, that's right.
I've never even seen a penis.
Yes, it's the first one you saw. Now, how many people can say that? I don't know, maybe a few, but, you know.
Probably, if it's Jimmy Page, probably a lot more. A lot, I don't know. But, you know, he was a young guy, too. It wasn't like he was molesting a child. I think he probably was, I don't know, probably under 21 years old. I'm, it's not that much. How much older
no,
is he?
No, he was about... He was probably 23 or so.
Oh, well, he should have known better.
But he was probably 23.
Nowadays, that would get you in a lot more trouble. Back when we talked about it, you know?
But you might have looked a little older, too, at that point.
Oh, I did.
You know,
I
you was, were all dolled up, probably.
And, oh, yes. Yeah. I was piling on the makeup and the big hairstyle and wearing short mini skirts. And, no, I was, you know, ready to go, but not emotionally. Not emotionally.
Yes, right. And rock stars then, you know, just assumed if a girl comes in, right, shows up, that's right. That's what they could do. And of course, it got much worse or better, or whatever you want to say.
Yeah, I don't know what it was. Yeah, I've been in so many rock stars' dressing rooms and hotel rooms and stuff, and it varies, you know. It back then it was pretty. You know, I don't know how. I would hate to even know what it's like now. Back then, you were putting yourself in a pretty risky situation, But yeah. Thank God, knock on wood, I never had any like really scary
right
things that I couldn't get away from.
Right, right. And thank goodness, because it also kept you, I mean, you never lost your love of music because of it or any of that. I mean, you kept going back.
Oh, hell yeah. I loved music. And, you know, like I've heard you say, I love music. Music was number one. And I honestly wanted to be a musician, but really then there were no right. women musicians.
Exactly. You couldn't even contemplate it, really.
Oh, you couldn't even say, I'm going to grow up and be a, you know, guitar player in a rock band. That just wasn't happening.
Yeah, it wasn't an option.
And there were the Ronettes or someone where you could be, you know, in a girl vocal group. But even then, that wasn't the same thing. It wasn't rock music, you know.
Which is well, there was Janis and Grace Slick.
But well, they hadn't even come along yet. Well, at that point.
They were just starting to come along. Yeah. They were fronting male bands. I mean, it was still not... Women were not picking up guitars or playing drums, or so, and our option was to hang out, to be near that music, was to be a groupie, right?
It was, and so, to hang out with the, like I say in my book, if I couldn't be a rock musician, I was going to be with a rock musician.
Yeah, exactly,
the closest thing you could get.
You got near actually. To me, the greatest guitar player who ever lived, better than Page or any Clapton or any of these other people. Jimi Hendrix.
I would agree 100%. Did you see that movie? What is it? God, I love the movie and it's going out of my mind. They Might Be Loud.
Oh, yeah. It Might Get Loud. Yeah.
Is that it? It Might Get Loud.
Yeah, with Jimmy Page, though.
Yeah, Jimmy Page. Jack White, who's a good friend, and a freaking brilliant guitar player.
Yes. Have you heard his new song? It's so great.
Oh, my God. Good. No, not the latest one.
Heard it. Good. But I'm talking about Hendrix now, because to me, I think it's dumb to compare people, but he's my favorite guitar player.
Yeah. Hendrix. Yeah. I love Hendrix. I still play his music all the time. In the house, I can't stop playing. I love everything Hendrix did. And I got to meet him too.
Yes, I know. That's the story I'm leading up to here.
Oh my God, I love Jimi Hendrix. And he was such an unusual, unique person, especially back then, where there weren't that many Black people involved in rock music. There
were almost none. He was pretty much it. There was a lot of great Black music being made, but not rock and roll like that. I mean,
absolutely.
And he had just blown so many people away, all the other musicians, you know, who saw him play the first time in England, for instance. They all said, okay, now what? Yeah. I'm going to have to really up my ante here, you know, all of them. And now we're going to take a little break and we'll be right back. Okay, we're here now with Cassandra.
It's true. He came in and like blew everybody out of the water. And, you know, I don't think anybody was expecting that. And he's so well respected by other musicians, too. I mean, you know, still to this day, when they talk about him, I talk to other musicians about Jimi Hendrix. I'm like,
I know there's not enough words to express how great he is. So you got to hang out with him.
I did.
For a short time. But he was a gentleman, unlike Jimmy Page. He was quite a gentleman with you.
Right? He was. And I probably had something to do with that. He was just about ready to walk out on stage at the Denver Pop Festival.
Right.
So he didn't have that much time to get jiggy with it. You know what I mean? It was very, very sweet. And we did have a little time to make out and smoke a doobie together and talk. And then he invited me back to his room after the show. He gave me his phone number. And that, sadly, I was so thrilled. I could not wait. And after the show, I called him. And when he finally answered the phone, first a girl answered. Oh. So that's a real buzzkill right there, right?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. And then she put him on the phone and he was just completely out of it.
Oh.
I don't know if he remembered who I was, anything. And the shitty part was I didn't get the hotel he was staying at. That was the world's crappiest part. I called into this place and it was just a direct number to this phone.
Huh.
You know, And so there was no way to find out what hotel or motel he was in.
Right, right.
And with the Denver Pop Festival going on, there were rock musicians in every single hotel in Denver. Yeah. You know, at that time, there were hundreds of them. That was the end of my Jimi Hendrix experience. But yeah. It was awesome while it lasted. And he was a doll. He was sweet. He was so kind.
He was such a gentle soul. And a really spiritual guy, because I was around him because of Noel Redding, who I was seeing at the time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. Whoa.
Oh, yeah. I was around him quite a bit. There was one time where I was with Noel in New York, and my friend Chuck Wine invited us to this big party. Chuck Wine was a real, I called him the wizard. He was my spiritual guru for a while there. And he was calling the archangels out of each corner, Michaelo and all that. Wow. And Hendrix was the only person who got up out of the room we were in, where everyone's smoking pot, and went into the room where Chuck was and was looking and for the angels in the corners.
Wow.
That's really who he was. That's really who Hendrix was. There was so much more to him than people realize. And I got to dance in his Foxy Lady video.
You did?
Yeah, I was the Foxy Lady in that video.
You're kidding me.
Yeah, oh my God,
I guess we never find that. Is it online anywhere?
No, it's impossible to find. His family now owns it, and she's a Christian girl, the stepsister. And she's not allowing people to see this stuff.
Oh, my.
There are little clips of it in his biography, the 2-hour biography of me flailing around. But I got to spend the whole day with them. And then Noel and I hooked up afterwards. Jimmy hit on me and I was too scared of him. I was still in high school, for God's sake. He was just bigger than life. He was just... His vibe, but wasn't his aura, his energy huge? I mean, it was.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, it was like he had a glowing halo around.
Yes,
his
hair.
It was like when I walked in that room and he was sitting on the end of the. Not a room. It was a little trailer that they had set up behind the stadium.
Yeah,
he was sitting there in the back. I swear, when I remember thinking about it, I swear he was like glowing. You know what I mean? And I honestly think it was the sun coming in from behind him in the window that made his afro look kind of like it was had a halo or something.
Yes.
You know, the first thing he did, unlike Mr. Jimmy Page, you know, grabbing me by the hand, not saying a word, and dragging me down there and start tearing my clothes off.
Yes.
He said, "What happened to you?" Because he could see I had a big red mark.
Oh, that's right. You.
I had gotten hit by tear gas, by a tear gas canister, and it had leaked some of the tear gas down my face and burned the side of my face, like just a bad, super red sunburn.
Yeah, yeah.
He jumped off the bed, grabbed a washcloth, ran under the water, and put it on my face, and said, "Oh my God, what happened? What happened? Are you okay? I mean." That's what he did.
That's how you wound up backstage, right? Was because you needed medical attention, for God's sake.
It was a lucky accident. I got beat right in the head. I was out. I got knocked out. Next thing I wake up, I'm in the back. And there.
Wow. You know, and there was Jimi Hendrix.
I mean, after leaving the Red Cross or whatever, medic, whatever that trailer was, I just started going back to my seat and I was back behind the stadium, you know, and I see this other trailer, and there's this big guy out there. I describe him as looking like a genie that came out of a bottle, and he goes, "You want to meet Jimi Hendrix?" I mean, I was like, "Do I, you know, are you kidding?" And he just like, well,
wow, that was kind of him.
Yeah, you know, if you think about the trouble you could get in if somebody said that and it wasn't really Hendrix, or, you know.
Yes, that's right. You put yourself in some really precarious situations. Mm-hmm. And here you are today, as glamorous and gorgeous and sweet and kind and brilliant as ever.
Oh, God. Thank you, Pamela.
Oh, you're so welcome. Well, let's hear a little bit of Foxy Lady since...
Okay.
You were with him and I danced in the video.
Yes.
Foxy.
Oh, Jimmy. Oh, my God. Oh,
I love that. Oh, my God. So much.
Yeah. You know, you gave me a list of songs that, and I'm not familiar with, I mean, why were you interested in Do You Believe in Magic? Just because you love that song?
Yeah, you know, I have a chapter in the book called Do You Believe in Magic? And I always kind of felt that me getting to where I am today was kind of magic, because I very much believe in your actions have consequences, and that what you sow, so shall you reap. You know, it's been in a million different, it's been in the Bible, it's been in the Quran, it's been in every
it's wisdom of the ages.
Yeah, and I believe that's kind of a kind of magic that most people don't believe in, unfortunately. But what you put out there comes back to you. So if you put out bad things, that comes back to you too. Put out good things.
Eventually, yes, I agree. Yes.
I mean, it has worked for me through my whole life. I have so many strange things that have happened. Like, I'll try to make it this kind of brief, but seeing Viva Las Vegas, the movie, when I was, I think, again, around 13, and dreaming about the movie, thinking about it, with, you know, with Elvis Presley and Anne Margaret, and I wanted to be Anne Margaret, and Elvis was my boyfriend, and I wanted to go to Vegas and be a showgirl, and I thought about it, and thought about it, and dreamed about it, and literally obsessed about it.
Yes.
By the time I was 17, I was working in Vegas being a showgirl. I met Elvis and hung out with him. I met Anne Margaret, and I was working in a show called Viva Lake Girls.
It is miraculous. It is miraculous. I really believe that what you imagine, you know, it's done unto you as you believe, our good Lord said. You believe it, you see it, you manifest it, and you obviously have done that a lot in your life.
A lot. I mean, yeah. I've had moments that were so bizarre. I was having this big crush on Nicolas Cage after he came out in Moonstruck.
Yeah.
Sitting in a bar, the Palace. Remember the Palace
Sure.
I was sitting in the Palace with my friend Sharon, and we were having a drink, waiting to see Ricky Lee Jones, who was playing that night. And I'm talking to her about Nicolas Cage. Now he's so hot in this movie. Oh my God, you have to see it. I get a hand on my shoulder. It's Nicolas Cage saying, "Can I buy you ladies a drink?" Okay, that happened. Then I was having a session about Brad Pitt. He shows up at my house.
Oh, no, that's a great story. Tell us the Brad Pitt story.
Oh, my God. I had this fantastic house in the Hollywood Hills at the time.
It was my God.
1901 Craftsman.
So incredible.
Huge house. And I was 9 months pregnant, and the doorbell rings, and it had a long driveway with a gate at the end with a spider web on the gate. And the doorbell rings, so I'm in the house, and I go, "Who is it?" And the person says, "Brad Pitt." And I immediately went, "Ah, that's so funny, John." I was sure it was my writing partner, John Paragon.
Yes.
And he says, I go, "Who is it, John? Wait, I mean, is that you?" And he goes, "No." I said, "Who is it?" He said, "Brad Pitt." And he said, "Ah, that's very funny." Kept going on like that. And I was thinking, he really does sound like Brad Pitt. And so finally I went out and I thought, I'll waddle down to the front gate to the axe murderer that's waiting there, you know, and see what's going on.
Now, you were pregnant. That's why you were
pregnant. 9 months pregnant. Okay. I was pop. And he said,
"You don't usually waddle, okay?"
Yeah, I was definitely waddling. I could barely walk. It was hot. It was in the summer. I was like, And I dragged myself down there. There at the gate is Brad freaking. I mean, he had just done Interview with a Vampire. What was that one where the kind of cowboy one? Where he had the long blonde hair, and then he was getting
what was that called? I know the one.
Legends of the Fall.
I can see him on that horse right now.
Oh, honey, me too. And yeah. I was pregnant, so I was having some crazy dreams about Brad at that time. Oh my God, I didn't tell my husband about it, but I was obsessed with Brad Pitt at that time.
And he showed up at your door.
He's at my door, and he said, "Can I come in and see your house?" It's like, can you get it? You know, it's like I couldn't open the damn gate fast enough. I mean, yes. I mean, I almost dropped the baby right there, you know, and that would have been a great story where Brad Pitt delivered my child. Oh boy. So I took him in the house. I showed him all around. I showed him old photos of when the house was built and took him all around the house. And he said, can I come back again and see it? And I said, sure. So he came back with his girlfriend.
Okay.
Monica, who was adorable and looked like the female Brad Pitt. and my husband was there too. So that was a bummer. But anyway, showed him around the house. Next day after that, we get a call from his lawyer asking if he can buy the house. And I was like, no, I mean, I was ready to have a baby. I'd fixed up the baby's room. You know how you are when you're going to have a child, you're kind of nesting, you know?
Yes.
And we said no. And then they came back with a bigger offer. And we still said no. And then they came back with another offer that we couldn't refuse. It was like, we're crazy if we don't. So that was my Brad Pitt story, but I ended up moving next door and saw him frequently. Because it was a private street and we could walk down. I'd run into him. And the best time I ran into him, he was working out in the garage on a punching bag, getting ready for Fight Club. And he had no shirt on, just like sweat pants. I almost fainted. I had to grab a hold of a tree. I couldn't. And he said, hi, how are you? And I couldn't talk. I was like,
I have heard that one. That's great.
Oh, it was so crazy. You know, what a great story was, one day I was sitting down at the little cafe at the bottom of our street in Hollywood, and I was with three other moms from my child's school, and I'm sitting there and we're just talking, and all of a sudden behind me comes up Brad Pitt and he goes, Cassandra, it's so great to see you. And I was like, oh, you too. And I'm hugging it. And the three moms, I just remember the look on their faces because I hadn't seen him in a while. And the look on these three women's faces, it was hilarious.
I'm sure you'll never forget that. That's so cool. What's wonderful about you, and part of the reason we relate so well too, is we're fans of people, you know. Yeah. Right. I mean, yes. I mean, not just musicians, but, you know, you get crushes on people from afar. And it's just part of that is just all about love. You know, it's all about.
And that's why I love my fans so much.
Yeah. You understand. Yeah.
Totally. I understand what they're thinking, what they're going through, and how important it is for that person that you idolize to be kind to you.
Oh, it's just everything. Everything.
It's just like a smile or a hello or anything.
Yeah.
I have been in situations where I was a fan of an actor and then met them and they were a total douche, you know, and it's just so hurtful. It's so hurtful.
I know it only takes a little moment of, you know, hi, nice to meet you. And it's over, you know, I mean, yeah, there's no excuse.
I mean, sometimes I'm busy. Sometimes I'm not in a good mood. Sometimes I'm unhappy. But if somebody comes up and goes, oh my God, you're Elvira, I don't believe it. I still go, yeah, thank you. Oh, that's so sweet. I pull it out of my butt.
Well, you're a really kind soul, you know.
Thank you.
You understand from being a fan and a groupie about what that means. And I think we should go into someone who wasn't that great, which is your first experience. Well, you can tell as much as you want to about it, but I think we should hear What's New Pussycat before we get into this story.
What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's new, pussycat? Whoa. Pussycat, I've got flowers and lots of hours to spend with you. So go and powder your cute little pussycat nose. Pussycat, pussycat, I love you. Yes, I do. You and your pussycat nose.
Well, okay. Tell us about that story.
Yeah, What's New Pussycat, the perfect song. You know, I wasn't a fan of Tom Jones at the time. I really didn't care about his music at all, but I was in Vegas being a showgirl, and the two guys that were in my show with me and were my best friends said, we got tickets to go see Tom Jones. And I was kind of like, well, yeah, okay. But Everybody on the strip was talking about, oh my God, this guy, you can't imagine. He's so hot and he's so talented and you got to see it. So I'm like, okay, well, you know, I'll go. So we're sitting in the audience and I tell you, were they right? Oh my God. He does have an amazing voice. I will give him that. He is a powerful, amazing singer. He was sexy as living hell. And he was from Wales, which I was still in love with anybody from the UK, you know.
Yes, me too. Accent.
Oh, yeah. It's like, oh God. And so I couldn't believe it. He was so hot. I thought, I was like, oh, he's hot for an old guy, you know. I was like, how old was I by then? 18 or 19.
Yeah, you were still so young.
Yeah, yeah. And I was still a virgin dancing in a show in Las Vegas as a showgirl, wearing nothing but a G-string. You know, I mean, hard to believe. Nobody believed me when I tell them, but it was true.
Your whole book is full of amazing stories like that. I mean, just one amazing story and experience after another. You guys, if you haven't read Cassandra's book, go out and get it.
Yeah, I hope you do. There's a one crazy story after another in there. So, but yeah, so I ended up backstage with Tom. I don't know. I can't even remember how I got there. I don't know if my friends Buddy and Sterling took me back there, or if I was saying like use my gate crashing tactics just for, you know, being a groupie.
Yes,
I got back there. Tom kind of glommed onto me. And we sat there talking and chatting. And the next thing I know, we're in bed together. And I'm no longer a virgin. But it was really horrible. It was, he didn't believe that I was a virgin. That, and there, you know, there was plenty of proof there, you know.
Yeah. Well, he was a thoughtless asshole.
Oh, thank you. Somebody had to say it. He was a jerk. I kept telling him I was a virgin. I hadn't done this before. And he didn't believe me, like laughed. And it was very painful. And I said I wanted to go home. And he got angry. He did call me a cab, thank God. I didn't have to hitchhike home. But it was a bad experience. I ended up going to the hospital the next day because the bleeding wouldn't stop. And ended up having stitches. It was just a horrible, horrible experience.
It is a horrible experience. But
the worst part, the follow-up, was going back when I was an actress in Hollywood. I mean, an actress looking for work in Hollywood and walking up to him and saying, hi, Tom, do you remember me? And him saying, oh, yeah, you're the one with the scars on your back, which I was very, very sensitive about. I had been burned as a child.
I know.
I was so sensitive about that. And him saying that was just like... dagger to the heart.
You
really have to say that.
Yes. That I'm glad you told that story because, you know, obviously it's a huge story about how men treat women and how long that's been going on and how it still goes on. And I think those stories need to be told 100%. And that was a tough one for you to go through and to tell. I know that.
Unfortunately I'd gone on the Howard Stern show and blabbed about the whole Tom Jones thing. That was how I got on the Howard Stern show. You had to have a juicy story, you know. I blabbed about that, and that, oh my God, I was like, why did I do that? Because everybody was coming up to me and it was all over the place.
What year was that?
Tom Jones. But I did Howard Stern, you mean?
Yeah.
God, what year was it? Who knows? It was a long damn time ago. It was probably the 90s or early 2000s, maybe.
That was really brave of you to bring that up then.
No, well, it was stupid, I think, not brave. But I never told anybody about going back to see him again.
Yeah.
That was more hurtful than the whole episode, you know.
Yeah. And did he just turn around and walk away at that point, or did you convert or anything?
Walk away.
I turned around and walked away. Good.
Yeah, because I didn't want to burst into tears.
Yeah. Yes. Cassandra got burned as a child. It's of course in the book. And it did color her life through the years as being something that, you know, that got in her way, mentally, emotionally. And it's so great that you, you know, you she reveals so much in this book, you guys. And I really want you to read it because it's just divine. And I'm so proud of her.
Oh, well, thanks to you. It's divine. I mean, you really got me on the road to doing it. You really did. And your insight and your suggestions and everything were just so, so right on.
Oh, good. God, I love it. Well, you know, I'm teaching women's memoir. I have been for 23 years, and it's really the best thing I've ever done. All the things I've done. But now we could talk about Elvis, okay? Because this is, of course, my favorite story in the book. Yeah. Being an Elvis freak with his signature tattooed on my back.
That is an Elvis fan. Right there.
Yes. And the first song that sent me on my path was his song Treat Me Nice, which was on the flip side of Jailhouse Rock. Mm. For those of you who don't know what a flip side is, that's when we had single 45 records, and the A side was the hit and the B side was usually the flip side. So the flip side of Jailhouse Rock was Treat Me Nice, and the words to that
song.
I was only 9. And I said, I wanted to, okay, how do you treat Elvis nice? What do you have to do? And I listened to the words over and over and over and over again. When I walked through that door, be polite. I'm like, I was obsessed, okay, from the age of 9. So you got the chance to spend a little time with him. And I would like to hear that story, please.
Yeah, well, I was obsessed too from the time I was 5, and I received a little record player from my mom and dad for Christmas. Yes. And a little 45 of You Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog. And I have tapes. I have 8mm tapes of me dancing to that. And I had made up the wackiest damn dance you have ever seen. Someday that's going to be in my documentary because people will laugh so hard.
Good.
So I made up this kooky little dance to You Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog. But I became a huge Elvis fan from then on, and because my parents were these gigantic Elvis fans. Mm. They had, you should have seen, they had a little shrine to him in our basement when I got older. There were like Elvis bottles and Elvis pictures and everything. They just loved Elvis. So I guess I got that from them. And ended up changing my life in a huge, huge way. I was lucky enough to, when I was a showgirl in Vegas at the Dunes, Elvis and his entourage came to see the show, which I couldn't believe it was happening. I'm in the show. He is watching me. And I was like, what the hell?
How did you get through it? Were you nervous up there?
Oh, I was, thank God, I was so nearsighted. I mean, I wore the thickest Coke bottle-like glasses my whole life until I was 30. You wouldn't believe how blind I was. So I was on stage. Thank God I couldn't see anybody's face or anything in the audience, you know? But I knew it was there, and I was just shaking, you know, the whole
through. Yes, the whole, yes. No.
And when the show got over, my best friend, who was a fellow showgirl, Jennifer, told me that she was going to Elvis's suite where he was having a party because she was dating Joe Esposito, his road manager. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. So she said, do you want to come along? And I was like, okay. I could not even believe.
Oh, my Lord. Why?
So we got out of our, you know, showgirl stuff and into our civilian wear and went over to Elvis's suite, which was by the time we got done with the show on the weekend, it was and got out of there, it was about 3 a.m. I think the last show started at 2. It was crazy. So 3:30 a.m. we go over there to the International Hotel, and his suite was the whole top floor of the International. And I just couldn't believe it. I'm standing there, I'm talking to Sonny and Red and all these guys, you know, and all of a sudden here comes Elvis. And well, we were talking about auras, but honest to God, the whole room was white. It had white carpet, white furnishings, white everything. And Elvis was dressed all in black. This is when Elvis was super hot, Elvis.
Yeah.
That TV special. You know,
he was so divine then. Oh my God.
Steve Bender special. Oh, that was such a great show.
Yes.
And there he was, you know, and just like there was a glow around his entire body. And he came up and introduced himself, super polite to everybody there. And then somehow I ended up sitting on the couch with him, talking. I mean, for hours. The day was coming up. And he told me that I should not be in Vegas. I was 17 at the time. He told me this is a ridiculous place for me to be. No girl should be there alone. I should get out of there. And I was like, but I'm here because of you, because I fantasized about Viva Las Vegas. And you're the person who made me want to come to Vegas, you know? And I've made it here. I'm a showgirl, you know, what's better than that? And he said, you really did. There's so much more. There's so much more to life. You don't need to do this. You can go somewhere else and do something else. And he and I sat down at the piano and we were singing together. What's wrong with him? It was ridiculous. And he said, you have a nice voice, you know? And I said, why don't you go? I had sung in the choir at school. That's all I'd ever done. And he said, why don't you go out, get some singing lessons and think about becoming a singer and get the hell out of Vegas. And if anybody on the planet had told me that,
yeah,
I would have said, screw you. I really would. But coming from Elvis, I was like, okay. And the next day I went out, I got vocal lessons. And within a month, I got a part in my show singing. And it sort of proved to me that, oh my God, maybe I can do this for a living.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm a great singer, but I could, you know, carry a tune. And but at the end of the night, I did get a very, very nice, passionate kiss from Elvis. And I couldn't. And I describe how I wasn't there in the moment. It's sad. I was thinking about, oh my God, I'm kissing Elvis. So, oh my God, wait till I tell everybody. You know that feeling?
Yes, I sure do. Because the first time I had sex with Mick Jagger, I was like, okay, I'm having sex with Mick Jagger right now. All right. This is happening. This is really happening.
Yeah, and you're just totally not really there in the moment. You know, you're just thinking about who you're going to tell. And oh my God. So
how did the kiss come about? Were you about to leave?
I was about to leave. His guys, that I don't know who they were, came and got him and said, Elvis, it's time for you to go to bed.
It
was like so weird. It was like he was like a little boy and they were telling him, you know, it's time for you to eat. It's time for you to sleep. It was so bizarre. They just came over and said, Elvis, time for you to go to bed now. And kind of led him away. And right as we were leaving and I was by the door, he just wrapped his arms around me and gave me this big, long kiss. And
wow,
I was dying. My knees were buckling. I couldn't believe it. And then they led him off to his room. And
that was that. And your life had changed.
Yes, change totally. Yeah. It really did change my life from that point on. I started, as I said, taking singing lessons. I got a part in my show singing A Good Man Is Hard to Find. Oh. And by the end of my contract, by the end of the year, I moved with the two guys, my two friends, Buddy and Sterling, mm-hmm. to Paris with them. And from there started looking for gigs as a singer in a band. And I ended up in a band in Italy.
Yeah.
The lead singer, myself, and another.
Those stories are so good. The European stories. So you saw yourself in Elvis's eyes. This is kind of what happened there. You saw yourself in a new light, which were in Elvis Presley's eyes.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess so.
Wow.
But when people do ask me about him, I do tell them he was so kind. He was, I hate to say fatherly, but he cared, you know. I told him, he asked if I'd done drugs. I told him I had. I mean, I had experimented with every drug out there, I think. And he was like, no, you cannot do that. I mean, he was very stern. He was like, no, don't do that again. Anything, nothing, not even marijuana. I didn't really take him up on all that, but yes. But he cared. He, you know, here he was talking to a young girl and he cared about how I was, how my head was. I was in Vegas. Not a good place for a young girl.
Well, and another part of that, which my favorite part of the story is the whole spiritual aspect.
Yeah, that is amazing. And you know, I tell you, this was so weird. This was another thing that I swear to God, I manifested. And that was that I'm really into The Secret, you know, by Rhonda Byrne. And I was reading her latest book. And
what's it called?
I knew you'd say that.
Oh. Sorry.
Something, The Greatest Secret, or The
I will look it up.
Sorry, everybody. My brain is, not what it used. Well, it never used to be good anyway. But I really was moved by this book. And it was all about exactly what we're talking about. Manifesting your life, manifesting your future, manifesting things you want to do, dreams that you have. And I was invited out to lunch by two friends of mine in Santa Barbara, and they said, oh, we're bringing a friend of ours with, you mind? And I was like, no, sure, that's fine. I kind of wanted to just hang with them, but I was like, yeah, sure. So I get there and the friend is Rhonda Byrne. And I'm in the middle of reading the book.
Oh,
and here I am talking.
Oh my God, Cassandra, that's so fabulous.
And we talked for like 2 hours, but getting back to the Elvis thing.
Yes.
He knew all about Elvis and how he completely believed in the whole manifestation thing. Oh, okay. And how he was also a big fan of the books that you and I love, and by these authors. And she gave me the name of a book, and I have it written down somewhere, that she said Elvis used to pass this book. She says a very, very thin book, almost like a booklet. He used to give this book to everybody. She said he'd buy them by the carton loads.
Oh my gosh, I have to know what it is.
I will find it. I wrote it down that day. I have it somewhere. But she said he was completely into that. And very few people know that. And you're the one that told me on his desk was the same book that I mentioned. And here I am blanking again.
Well, he had Paramahansa Yogananda's book on there. And also Science of Mind stuff.
Science of Mind.
Yes.
Which I've been into for my whole life.
Yes, me too. And he had all that on his desk. And Lisa Marie, chose to show that. You can see his desk and those books right now at Graceland if you go there.
Yeah, I am dying to go to Graceland. I've never made it there.
Oh my gosh, you have to go. I'd love to go with you. Wouldn't that be a trip?
You should go there and film the whole thing.
Yes. So they don't allow you to film.
Ah, damn it. What if we got a film crew that they wanted to do it?
Maybe. I've been there twice. And you have to get the VIP, because then they don't kick you out. You can stay there all day if you pay the VIP price. All over the grounds, and where his cars are and his tennis court and all that stuff. And you can go in and out of the rooms. Of course, you can't go upstairs, but you might be able to.
Those developers will come and get me and take me up there. I've heard it's fabulous. My manager went there not long ago, and he just said, you have to. It's so incredible.
It is. It's also, it's like going back to 1974, which is when he had it redecorated and everything. It's like a time warp into 1974, of the colors, everything about it. So besides it being Elvis's house, it's like being immersed in the past as well.
Well, it was really weird. I became friends with Joe Esposito, the guy who was Elvis's tour manager.
Oh,
we became friends for years later when I had a roommate in New York. Another manifestation thing, I think.
Yes. His
friend, named Martha. In New York City, not a roommate, she lived down across the street, and she and I hung out together. She was kind of my only friend in New York City. I was very lonely when I was there and couldn't really meet people. And she was a good friend, and we hung out together a lot and everything. We were both starving, struggling actresses. And she disappeared one day. I don't know what happened. All of a sudden, she was gone. She was in her apartment. I couldn't believe that she didn't let me know or anything. It was kind of sad.
Yeah.
And one day, maybe 30 years later, I was at a big fancy party, and I see Martha, and she sees me, and we run over to each other. Oh my God, I can't believe it. She said, I had to leave because my parents had an emergency, and I left, and I planned on coming back, but I never got to come back, so I couldn't get a hold of you, and blah blah blah.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
And then she said, I just got married. I said, what are you doing? And she goes, I just got married, you have to meet my husband. She takes me over. It's Joe Esposito. Oh my God, from Vegas, from Elvis. And we became
friends.
Yeah. And Joe used to say all the time, I've got to take you to Graceland. You've got to go with us so I can give you the royal treatment there.
Oh,
We became friends, really good friends with Martha and Joe, and hung out for many, many years after that. Both passed away. Yeah, and I was always thinking I was going to go to Graceland with Joe.
Yes, that would have been the way to go.
Wouldn't that have been fabulous?
Yes. Well, why don't we hear then, you know, the song that started it all for you, Hound Dog.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, girl.
Okay, there's no denying that music. Okay, he started everything, you know, opened all those doors for so many people.
Yep. And it was sad when he passed away. It was devastating for me.
I bet.
And of course, it was from drugs. I know,
but of course they were all prescribed. Yeah. You know,
all prescription drugs.
Yeah. So
and, you know, they're giving it like just like so many artists. I mean, from Judy Garland up to Prince and Michael Jackson. It's
so
like
bad.
The people that you work with, your whoever it is, your management, your PR people, whatever. I imagine, I'm pretty positive, they were giving him drugs to have more energy when he was tired because he had to perform. Giving him drugs at night to go to sleep because he couldn't sleep. Mm-hmm. Giving him drugs for pain because he's blowing out his knee.
Pain has caused so many people to, Tom Petty, you know, there's so many people who get involved, who Prince, you know, the fentanyl and all that stuff now. And it's just so tragic. Oy, oy, oy. But let's not go there right now.
Yeah, I mean, really.
I just want to thank you. We've already talked for an hour. It's amazing. We can just continue talking another few hours. But I just want to thank you for being here. And I want, you know, we didn't even get into your Elvira story. So you're all going to have to get the book to read that one.
But yours truly, Elvira. Don't forget.
Yes, yours truly, Elvira. Bestseller. New York Times bestseller. And now it's coming out, you said, in paperback, huh?
Yeah, it'll be a really great release in the fall paperback. We're going to have different covers for collectors.
Fabulous.
And I'm putting more material in it, some of the material that we had to cut, and adding some more photos in it. So it'll be
good.
Yeah, it'll be a fun.
That is so clever, honey.
Thank you.
And you're going to continue being Elvira. I'm sure.
Well, I probably, you know, maybe not in person as much, but certainly I think Elvira will continue on even when I'm not there to support her, so to speak.
You'll live forever. Are you kidding?
I hope so. You know, look at Elvis. He's working more than ever and he's not.
Yes, that's right. A lot of the letters are the same even.
It's true.
Your name.
That was kind of a coincidence, isn't it?
Yes.
It be like, oh, they just sort of showed up. My signature actually looks so much like him. I've had a few people comment that when I sign Elvira, it looks like Elvis.
Ooh.
Yeah. So.
And you still have that piece of paper that he scribbled some like numerology stuff on for you, right?
I just sold it in an auction. I sold it finally in an auction. I sold off some of my best memorabilia. I still got a ton, but I tell you, I was becoming kind of like a hoarder. I had 4 or 5 storage units, and it was just like, I have got to start doing something with this stuff. It's got to go because it should see the light of day. It shouldn't be stuck away in a.
I understand. I started letting go of some of my rock stuff, you know, not too long ago.
Yeah,
I understand. Some lucky person. I bet they're in Japan.
Probably it went for a pretty darn high price. So,
wow, honey, good for you. Good for Elvis. Elvis is taking care of you still.
He is. Oh my God, this is fun, Pamela. Let's do this every day.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm going to come visit you sometime this year, I promise.
Oh God, please, please, please.
Okay, honey. Mwah. Thank
all
you.
Right. Love you, Pamela.
Bye.
Okay. Bye.
Do you believe in magic in a young girl's heart? How the
music can free her whenever it starts, and it's magic if the music is groovy and makes you feel happy like an old time movie. I'll tell you about the magic and the free your soul, but it's like trying to tell a stranger about a rock and roll. Oh, you believe in magic, don't bother to choose if it's junk and music.
So you guys have to run out and buy Cassandra's book. It's, you know, we just barely touched the surface of all the incredible stories she reveals. I mean, the fact that she was a groupie, pretty cool and proud of it, you know. She's in my Let's Spend the Night Together documentary for VH1 I did about 10 years ago. And I also have a book of that name, Let's Spend the Night Together, which is a whole compilation of mainly classic groupie stories, which I'm sure you'd all enjoy. And I also have a couple memoirs. I'm with the band and take another little piece of my heart. A groupie grows up, but not necessarily. I have not really grown up. I have an incredibly youthful heart. And I hope you continue to tune in to my beautiful, wonderful, happy Pantheon podcasts. And, you know, check me out all over the internet. You know, I do rock tours. I do tons of writing workshops, so I am pretty out there. So find me, and I'll see you next time.
You've been listening to Pamela DeBar's Pajama Party, produced by Aaron Alden and Christian Swain. All sound design by Jerry Danielson and Busy Signal Studios. Find Miss Pamela at Pamela DeBar on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. Find all the Pantheon podcasts at pantheonpodcast.com or wherever you find great podcasts. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/pantheonpodcasts. Rock and Roll Archaeology on Instagram and Pantheon Pods on Twitter. It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.